I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich continue to lash out at one another today, just a day ahead of tomorrow's Florida primary race, which has ping-ponged between the two. Last week, Gingrich surging in Florida. Romney now ahead 43 to 29 points in the new Quinnipiac poll. Ron Paul and Rick Santorum tied at about 11% apiece. On CBS this morning, Gingrich said Romney is not the conservative choice.
Governor Romney ran as a liberal, basically, in Massachusetts, pro-abortion, pro-tax increase, pro-gun control, and he's bought an amazing amount of ads to try to pretend he's somebody he's not.
On Fox and Friends this morning, Romney dismissed Gingrich's attacks.
You know, desperate times, I guess. It really has been very sad and painfully revealing about the speaker to see him railing on like this.
Mark Caputo of the Miami Herald is with us again. Mark, Time Magazine says Romney outstumped and outspent Gingrich. But on the Today Show, Romney said he's surging because he changed tactics, he fought back, he used what he says are Gingrich's ties to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Is Romney right, or is something else going on?
I'd say he's right, but it's more than just that. We did a poll that ran this weekend. A solid majority found that Newt Gingrich's ties to Freddie Mac was a bad thing. They viewed it unfavorably by a good number, whereas Mitt Romney's ties to Bain Capital was viewed very favorably. Romney certainly won the message war, but it's more than just that. Romney had the sense to step out of the way when Newt Gingrich started running around with scissors. And, you know, Gingrich was flailing around. He tripped and stabbed himself a bunch of times. He did it repeatedly.
Well, how so? How so? Give us examples. Well,
here's a quiz. What was Newt Gingrich's message this week?
That Mitt Romney lies.
Yeah, you know, that's not very much. And by the way, he got to that message at the end of the week. At the beginning of the week, his message was Mitt Romney hires people who used to work for former Governor Charlie Crist. That was Tuesday. Then what happened Wednesday? Marco Rubio slapped him around saying, hey, look, you're running an ad that calls Mitt Romney anti-immigrant, and you're basically indicting the entire Republican Party's position on immigration. Take it down. Gingrich had to do that, lost another day. Then comes Thursday. He loses that debate as well. So, you know, by Friday and Saturday, he's reduced to doing what he did in Iowa, which was complaining Mitt Romney lies and I'm being attacked. You know, if it wasn't for the southern slash pines and the palm trees and the blue winter skies here, you'd think this is Iowa all over again. And the results are starting to look like it's going to be just like that, except it's Florida, a lot bigger state.
Well, so you're describing what sound like rounds, you know, in a boxing match. What about the impact of female voters? A survey in 12 decisive states found that 47% of women believe that Gingrich's personal life, having had an affair with his current wife while still married to his second wife, is an issue. Is that resonating? You know, what are some of the other things that you're hearing on the ground?
Well, our poll showed a double-digit lead among female voters in Mitt Romney's favor when matched against Newt Gingrich. The infidelity issue is probably hurting Newt Gingrich.
Well, and when you throw in early and absentee voting, which we know the Mitt Romney machine in Florida had been working hard on, that would seem to, you know, throw so many more votes his way. Republican lawmakers in a lot of states are trying to shrink this window for early voting, but it seems to be having a very positive impact for Mitt Romney.
There's probably been almost 600,000 early votes that have been cast by Republicans in this election alone. Remember, South Carolina just cast 601,000 votes on Election Day. There's probably going to be 2 million total ballots that are going to be cast in Florida this primary.
We're hearing about campaign surrogates for Mitt Romney showing up at Gingrich events and engaging, you know, people in debates. Are you seeing that?
Yeah, well, we saw Connie Mack, the congressman, son of the former U.S. senator, who's now a U.S. Senate candidate, following Gingrich's campaign around and kind of doing the same thing. It's been kind of a twofer for Connie Mack here because he's running for U.S. Senate against Bill Nelson. So he's getting a little free media time. 2004, you saw the same thing in the Republican Senate race between Mel Martinez and Bill McCollum. I mean, it was brutal. It was vicious. They do this in Florida, and by the way, they continue to win at general elections.
Well, just one last question. We've noted Ron Paul isn't concentrating on Florida. Rick Santorum has a three-year-old who suffers from a rare chromosome disorder. She had to be hospitalized over the weekend. Now, he's obviously very emotional about her. He always gets, you know, choked up when the subject comes up in debates. Is he going to be able to continue if this little girl is sick?
I have three daughters. I wouldn't be able to continue, but I'm not Rick Santorum. It's a better question for him.
Yeah, we'll see what happens there. Hope she gets better. Mark Caputo of the Miami Herald with the latest on tomorrow's primary in Florida. Mark, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
There's a new trend in Florida and across the country, pawn shops. Now, when I say pawn shops, do you think desperate customers, owners eager to turn their misfortune into personal gain? In the bleak movie Pawnbrokers, a customer tries to convince a pawnbroker he did not steal the item he wants to pawn.
A friend give it me. Now, he figure I make use of it.
Give it $30.
Well, now, as the founder of a popular chain of pawn shops puts it, pawn shops are the new target, often brightly lit, family-friendly, tweeting specials, hosting Facebook pages, and some of the owners have become stars.
So what do we got here?
This is my 1602 Shipwreck Dutch East India Company bell.
I just love old shipwreck items. You can just imagine the journey they've been on.
This ain't right. I don't think this thing was in salt water for any period of time to mount to anything. Let's get somebody to look at it before we go any farther.
Fair enough.
A scene from the popular History Channel show Pawn Stars that features a quirky Las Vegas shop. It is more Antiques Roadshow than the pawnbrokers. That bell, by the way, could fetch up to $15,000 at auction. But still, these shows, there are a handful, are part of the reason for the newfound popularity of pawn shops. The other is the economy. Let's take a deeper look today with Professor Paige Marta-Skiba, an economist at Vanderbilt University Law School who studies the pawn industry. Professor, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Also, Lawrence Calden. He's CEO of La Familia Pawn and Jewelry, 14 stores in Florida, another 5 in Puerto Rico. Lawrence, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And let's start with you, Lawrence. First of all, just remind us, how exactly does a pawn shop work?
We do two things primarily. We do loans, lending to customers on a short-term basis, and we also do retail sales at about a discounted rate, 25% to 75% of the new price. The loans are normally a short-term loan, you know, 2 weeks to 4 weeks.
Someone will bring something in, a ring, a watch. They will give it to you. You will give them a certain amount back in loan, but also with an interest rate.
Correct. Yeah. So they'll come in and they'll say they have a certain amount they want to borrow. You know, we'll negotiate on that amount and give them what we feel is a fair amount. And they'll walk out with the cash.
And so they need the quick cash. But how long do you wait before selling the item if they don't come back?
Actually, here in the state of Florida, up to 60 days. So if they decide they don't come back, it's 60 days before we're allowed to put it out for sale.
And by the way, there are state laws, vary state to state, laws that, as you just said, restrict the time frame in which you can sell something, but also cap how high that interest can go?
Correct.
Okay. And tell us about your stores, Lawrence. What do they look like?
Most of our stores are about 2,000 square feet on the showroom and about 3,000 to 4,000 square feet back room for storage.
Boy.
But they're well lit. We have a professional dress code. Guys wear ties, women wear professional attire. We get our floors done, you know, once a month. We make sure it's well lit, parking lots are clean. And we're pretty fanatical on our cleanliness. And we're not located like in the really bad areas. We're kind of located in between. And we market a lot, and we market the cleanliness too.
Well, when you say market, you have social media, you use Groupons?
Yes, we do use Groupons, social media, we use billboards, we do a little bit of TV, we do a little bit of radio when we're doing specials.
And on your Facebook page, we see you are now offering a Zumba class.
Yes.
So
we did that this past weekend. This past weekend, one of our stores in Kissimmee did that.
How many people did you have come in?
We must have had, you know, 40 or 50 in the pictures I saw.
Doing a Zumba dance class in your pawn shop.
Yes.
Professor Skiba, this is not your grandfather's pawn shop. There is this new trend, these chains that almost look like box stores. Do we still have the sort of back alley mom and pop stores that we're familiar with?
Yes and no. So pawn shops have changed a lot since the 1960s movie Pawnbroker. Pawn shops look much more like a bank on the inside or even a retail store. You know, they sell items and they're also a lending institution. And they have become much more mainstream. Although that being said, you know, pawn shops have been a really popular source of credit for Americans for a long time. They've been around since at least the 18th century. So there certainly has been a resurgence in the last few decades, but people have been using pawn shops regularly for a long time.
Well, and these are people who maybe can't get a loan from a bank. How would you characterize pawn shops? We have this image of these, well, it's predatory, you know, people giving desperate people who come in maybe just a few dollars for something that might be worth much more. And they have a very high interest rate on that, which makes it almost impossible for people to get back their beloved items, you know, family jewelry. But they also, I would say, could be lifesavers for people who have no other way to get cash.
It is the case that it's often lower income people, sometimes unemployed. Of course, to borrow on a pawn shop loan, you don't need a job, you don't need a bank account. But in fact, about half of borrowers who use pawn shops have a checking account. So you see that it's not necessarily the desperate people that are using pawn shops. People often have sources of traditional credit and turn to pawn shops. They can be quite expensive, but in fact, relative to other types of consumer credit, especially credit cards, even payday loans, they are much cheaper. So it can be a cost-effective alternative to mainstream sources of credit.
So you're saying that, you know, if you're going to get 18, 20% interest on a loan somewhere, you know, if you can get 5% interest on it at a pawn shop, why not?
That's right. Typically, people link pawn shops together with payday loans, which are very expensive short-term loans. Pawn shops are much, much cheaper than payday loans. Payday loans come with triple-digit interest rates, typically 500% annualized interest.
I probably should jump in to remind people we've done a lot of reporting on this. Payday loans are these storefronts that will give you a loan on your paycheck with this huge interest and usually a very short period of time in which they require you to pay it back. So people, you know, may get $1,000 and end up with $8,000. It's just a terrible spiral. Some states are really investigating the payday loans. But we're also reading that payday lenders are increasingly running pawn shops.
That's right. Many payday loan outlets are physically located inside a pawn shop. Just like people can find pawn shops to be very cost effective if they use them for short-term emergencies, the same can be said for payday loans. Even though they come with very high interest rate, these different types of alternative financial sources can help people out of a jam. If your car broke down and you can't get to work tomorrow unless you have $50, they can really be a lifesaver.
Well, and Lawrence, tell us about that. Who do you see coming in to your La Familia pawn and jewelry shop, which again is a pawn shop, not payday loans. We'll put those aside.
Correct. Really, our average loan, when you look at our entire portfolio, is $150. People that do have their car break down, people that overextended themselves like Americans do, banks don't loan $150 to somebody. No matter how good your credit is, nobody on this call could get a loan for $150. So pretty much everybody that needs a short-term, has a short-term need for cash, the only place to get it, really, is a pawn shop.
We're talking about the new pawn shop, a form of banking for some people, a new shopping source for others, brightly lit big box stores with weekly specials. Some stores have online operations. Vanderbilt professor Paige Marta-Skiba and Lawrence Calden, who owns the La Familia pawn shop chain, are both with us. Lawrence, at the La Familia shops, how much interest would you charge, say, on a loan of $150?
They would pay us back anywhere from 170, 250 to 187, so anywhere from 15% to 25%.
We're reading about people. Oh, here's an example: someone pawning an iPhone to pay a phone bill. A mall janitor coming in with jewelry that she swept up while cleaning. And then here's a couple that pawned their jewelry to get a $1,500 loan to keep their machine company afloat. Do these sound familiar, Lawrence?
Yes. We have a lot of people, actually small businessmen, that, and I'll use an example, a guy that owns an ambulance company that does some transportation of elderly. He depends a lot on some government grants and government money. So when he comes up short or is waiting for the government to give him his, you know, reimbursement, he'll come borrow, you know, $10,000 at a time. He has two really big diamond earrings. He'll come back, pick them up. He makes his payroll, you know, once he gets his money back from the government. So we have a lot of small business owners. We're seeing that more and more.
Wow, I'm thinking those are big earrings. But also,
you know,
as you've been saying, Professor, we hear about small businesses that have this problem where they constantly need to take out loans. It's sort of a juggling act to make payroll. They're going to pawn shops to do this. Your thoughts on that? Is that common?
One thing that's very common that we haven't discussed yet is that pawn shops are meant to be for short-term credit. They can be very cost-effective if you pawn something for a month or two. But typically, people renew their pawn loans many times in a row. So you end up paying multiple interest payments month after month. And so that's where people can get in trouble, is when they start using pawn shops as a more regular way to manage their finances. That's much harder for me to think about being a rational way to use credit. They probably would be better off selling their one valuable necklace rather than pawning it month after month or making interest payments. So people can get in these cycles of debt. So I don't think pawn shops are all good all of the time, but they can make sense for people. They can also get people in trouble.
Right. Well, Lawrence, tell us about that. On average, how many people are able to come back for the thing that they pawned?
Actually, you'll be surprised. About 75 to 80% pick up their items. On the other side, we do buy a lot. I would say 30% of our transactions. So for every 10 transactions, 7 will be loans and 3 will be actual purchases. If it's something they don't want to come back for, we'll make an offer to buy it.
And how many times do you have the person, you know, the one that's the stereotype in our mind's eye, who's begging you in the snow there in Florida, you know, please, it was my mother's ring. I can't afford the interest. Can I please? You know, how many times does it not end well?
Not very many times. We're pretty much up front on the front end of it. And a lot of times, even when the stuff does forfeit and it does come out for sale, if it's a customer that's been with us or it's something valuable like that, a lot of times we will hold that item and we'll try to work it. We'll try to work it out with them. But that's very, very rare.
It's still going to be heartbreaking.
Yes, it's very, yes. And yes, that's where the human element comes in. We the manager is able to make that decision if that ever happens. Yeah.
Professor, your sense of that sense of, what have I done? I, you know, pawned the family jewels and they were worth more than what I ended up with.
I think that actually helps people in the end. So I have done research on the ways in which people use pawn shops when they have different items pawned. So if you have pawned something sentimental, like your wedding ring, you have a good incentive to get that back. The same goes for if you pawn your TV or tools, you can't use them. There's a consumption value lost while they're in hock. And so people actually seem to make pretty good decisions when it's either something sentimental, a family heirloom, or something very useful to them. So I actually have compared to what extent it appears that people are rational using these different types of alternative financial services. When it comes down to losing a valuable item to you, people seem to do a good job of managing their pawn loans.
The other perception people have, Lawrence, about pawn shops is this stuff has to be hot. How do you prevent against theft?
Statistics-wise, it's about less than 0.1% of the stuff that comes in that is stolen. So if you figure for every $100,000, that's $100. Because we're heavily regulated. So if you come in to pawn something, you got to give your thumbprint. You got to give your ID. In some states, you have to take a picture of the customer. So the pawn shop really is the last place you would want to bring something stolen because it's going to track right back to you.
Professor, just some, you know, some closing comments on, as we're hearing, as you said at the outset, this is a real off-the-radar form of banking.
These are just not fringe elements anymore. An estimated 2% of households in the U.S. use pawn shops. That's millions of people. And people are, especially when the economy is not doing well, people are turning from traditional sources of credit to these other types. And I think it's not necessarily a bad thing. As I said, people can get in a lot of trouble with things like pawn shops or payday loans. But for your average customer, it's a short-term loan. It's a few dollars. It helps them make ends meet when they have a financial shortfall. So I think people will increasingly be turning to pawn shops. There's much less stigma attached to them. The stores are cleaner. People think of it more as a consignment shop or an antique shop or an electronics store than a gritty pawnbroker.
Yeah. Lawrence, what's the number one item that people are pawning now?
Gold. Gold is pretty big just because of the price of gold. But I would say in general merchandise, one thing that's really picked up have been, you know, video game systems and cell phones. With cell phones, the technology just keeps going up and up and up, so they'll get rid of their old cell phone and, to us, get their new cell phone through their company.
And, Lawrence, we mentioned that one owner says pawn shops are the new Target. Others have said it's like eBay right in front of you. You know, you can see it. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing people use pawn shops instead of those big box stores?
Yes. Yes, I mean, like I said, we've become more mainstream, and I think, you know, really the TV shows have kind of raised the curiosity of customers, so they're coming in, and when they come in, people get hooked on it.
Lawrence Calden, CEO of La Familia Pawn and Jewelry, with stores in Florida and Puerto Rico. Professor Paige Marta-Skiba, an economist at Vanderbilt University Law School who studies the pawn industry. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The fighting that's been raging for a year in Syria now seems more civil war than Arab Spring uprising. Today there are reports that the Syrian army has regained control of some suburbs of Damascus that had been held by rebel forces. There will be a push at the UN this week by Britain, France, and the Arab League for a resolution that would effectively call for President Bashar al-Assad to step down. The resolution is expected to have enough support to at least come up for one vote, but Russia is expected to veto it. The BBC's Richard Galpin has this report on Russia's ties to Syria.
The haunting sound of gunfire and explosions in the Syrian city of Hama as people shout "God is great" from nearby buildings. It's impossible to verify, but the man filming this violence says the security forces are shelling the district. Most of the weapons used by Syrian forces have been supplied by Russia. And even though the UN estimates that 5,500 civilians have been killed since last March, Moscow continues to send its longtime ally arms and ammunition. The latest consignment arriving by ship a few weeks ago, prompting a strong rebuke by Britain's ambassador to the United Nations, Mark Lyle Grant.
We are concerned about the supply of weapons into Syria. It is glaringly obvious that transferring weapons into a volatile and violent situation is irresponsible and will only fuel the bloodshed.
And the violence has surged recently, with the opposition refusing to be intimidated and even taking control in some areas with its own rebel fighters. Civil war looming ever nearer. Moscow insists it's doing nothing wrong. It's not part of an arms embargo and has contracts with Syria it says it has to honour. It also wants to maintain its navy base in Syria, Russia's only base in the Mediterranean. At a recent news conference, the Syrian foreign minister, Walid al-Mualem, said he'd spoken to a Russian minister and was assured Moscow's position towards Syria was strong. In other words, Russia would continue to protect its ally by vetoing resolutions at the United Nations Security Council. But siding with the Syrian government is leaving Moscow increasingly isolated. Salman Sheikh is director of the Brookings Institution in the Gulf state of Qatar.
The Gulf states in particular have got more and more upset that these arms are now feeding and supporting the efforts of the regime, and the Russians are standing firm against any kind of a UN effort to impose an arms embargo on Syria.
So, with diplomatic activity now resuming at the UN Security Council, is there a chance Russia will rethink its support for Syria, enabling the international community to take a united stand on the crisis? Konstantin Kosachev, deputy head of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Russian Parliament, clearly does have doubts about backing the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad.
We do have a feeling which becomes stronger that there is a kind of a game being played by Mr. Assad and his government. He does make promises, but he never fulfills these promises. So we are not happy with Mr. Assad, but we do believe that Mr. Assad and the civil society of Syria still have a chance to communicate with each other and to have a political dialogue with each other.
That means Russia will oppose the draft resolution now before the Security Council, because in effect it calls on President Assad to resign quickly. But Mr. Kosachev did warn that if dialogue does not get underway, Russia will change policy and allow Security Council resolutions to pass. The Syrian journalist and opposition spokesman in Britain, Malik al-Abdeh, believes that would be a critical moment.
If Russia stops supporting the Syrian regime, I think the regime will feel extremely isolated, will feel weakened. People within the regime, influential members of the regime, will try to look for an escape route. They will try to defect to neighbouring countries, and this is when the regime will probably crumble very quickly.
That report from the BBC's Richard Galpin. Florida recently released its ranking of the state's 67 school districts based exclusively on scores from the FCAT, the Florida Comprehensive Assessment Test. That ranking idea came from Governor Rick Scott, but top school officials are taking exception to it, saying the test alone is not a good way to measure school success. There are similar controversies elsewhere. New York's governor says he wants to tie state money to test performance, but more than 600 principals across New York have already signed a letter protesting a similar proposal from the federal government. While in Illinois, teachers say there have to be better ways than testing to evaluate schools. Rick Roach agrees. He's long doubted the tests, and then he took them. Rick has served for 13 years on the Board of Education in Orange County, Florida. He's a father of five with a Bachelor of Science and two master's degrees. Rick, how did you do on the test you took?
On the math test, which was full of algebra, geometry, and a little bit of calculus, I think, I did very, very poorly. There were 60 questions, and I have to tell you, I didn't know the first one.
Wait a minute, did you know any of them?
Not one. It's all math that I passed back in high school, but haven't used it since. That was the math part of it. The reading part, which is, I was probably more surprised, I had a 62%. That's how I did on the 10th grade version of our state assessment test.
Not very well. And we're going to have some of the tests. We'll link to some of this at our website so people can do it for themselves. So you didn't do well on these tests, and listeners can see how they do, but what do you take from that?
One way to explain it is that the state assessment reading is a different planet than learning to read, pick up things that you need to learn and that you want to learn. It's two different skills. I mean, I don't think anybody can question, Robin, that I can read. So to say that I am a 62% reader on the FCAT is got to be a different world. So my thought is, if it happened to me, what are we holding kids accountable for who have made A's and B's in every one of their classes in high school for four solid years and yet flunk an FCAT, a Florida assessment test in reading? It doesn't match.
Well, you go on to say in notes to a friend of yours, Marion Brady, the educator, if I'd been required to take these two tests when I was in 10th grade, my life would almost certainly have been different. I'd have been told I wasn't college material. It makes no sense to me that a test with the potential for shaping a student's entire future has so little apparent relevance to adult real-world functioning. You ask, you know, who decides this? Using what criteria? Who oversees them? Who are they accountable for? In other words, the people who put together this test. What's been the response to that?
About 98% of everybody who's personally contacted me has told me that I was, number one, a hero, a leader, it's about time. And Robin, the stories that have come out from people who are in their 50s now who were told when they were teens that they would not be college material or that they weren't very smart, and then they went on to be successful and kind of thumbed their nose at those people later on, are amazing.
But on the other hand, you know, you've had your critics. I'm reading Scott Hewler in Scientific American saying, I mean no disrespect, but the problem isn't with the test. It isn't even with the colleges that gave you your advanced degrees. The problem lies with your middle school. You should have gotten these right. Others are saying, well, maybe you wouldn't get them right now, but that doesn't mean that a 10th grader wouldn't get them right. None of us can remember some of these math formulas. You talk to all these business people that you know, and none of them use math in their business. But other critics have pointed out, well, but we don't know in 10th grade who's going to be the kid that's going to need that math in their business. I mean, just reply to some of those criticisms.
Number one, a lot of people guard the test with their lives. They really are not looking at the objective part of it. And I think a lot of people, they hear me saying two things. One, they hear me saying that math is not important, and that's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is everyday relevant math is what's important. If you really look at the professions in this country, there's probably a minimal amount of professions that actually use that data today as we speak. So why are we requiring such higher level math? I'm not opposed to kids learning math principles and multiplication, division, and subtraction, addition, and percentages and what have you. But I think that we're forcing kids to use a math that just is not relevant to them at this point. And I've gotten a lot of nice articles about that, too.
But others would debate that idea as well, that when you talk about relevance, you know, for instance, am I still using my algebra? No. But what you get from math isn't just remembering the equation in case you need to use it in the future. You get the critical thinking, the brain toning that comes with learning the math, even if you never use the math again.
My friend Marion Brady and I have been really, really active in digging out the research for that and cannot find any transference whatsoever in the higher level math thinking transferring to other things in our life.
Really?
And even if it were, yes. And even if it were, Robin, you can engage critical thinking with many, many topics that would be of high interest levels to kids, where they can be successful at it and still gain the critical thinking skills versus only going through this higher level math routine.
Well, but again, I mean, you know, it goes back to people who say it isn't about the fact that you might be using the particular math in your job. It's about the critical thinking skills. But then there are people who say you might be using this. And the United States has been falling behind other countries in math and science. And we know, you know, with the high-tech world that we all live in, that's the direction of jobs. Are you at all concerned about that?
Well, I think if you might need the math, you absolutely ought to take the math. It's a track you should be on. If you need the graphic arts background to be successful, you need to be tracked into that with a high emphasis in those areas. Your goal in life, your profession in life that you're trying to attain ought to dictate what you take versus the other way around.
Rick Roach, I know that you've been applauded, as you said, 90% of your email, that big stack you have, but you've also found yourself with a big target painted on you.
Oh, and I'm okay with that, Robin. I really am, and it's not about people agreeing with me. I did it because I just felt it was time for me to say, okay, if 39% of our 10th graders are passing the reading test and 61% are not, what's going on? Are we really, really that bad? Are these 61% of our high school 10th graders really below grade level? The answer is no. I went to a reading FCAT class the other day and talked to about 24 sophomores. One of the girls told me, Mr. Roach, I don't think I'm supposed to be in here. She says, I did fail the FCAT. I wasn't feeling very well that day, but I have all honors classes. And I asked the principal, I said, what is the grades this kid has? She has 6 A's in her honors classes and 1 B, and she's sitting in a remedial reading class learning how to read. These kids get put into an academic jail because some test says they can't read. It's just not right. We're withholding, I think in our county, I think the number is going to be about 300 last year, that were 3.0 GPA kids in 24 courses for 4 years, and they do not have on them a high school diploma. That cannot be fair. So, I don't know, attackers and arrow shooters, come on, but that can't be fair for kids.
Rick Roach, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you, Robin.
So I was waking up to our local morning edition here at the Mothership, WBUR Boston, when I heard this shimmering music between reports. So I called the technical director, Mike Toda, and said, what is that? He said, it's Vile. I said, I don't know, I really like it. He said, no, Kurt Vile, and the song is Runner Ups.
Hey, old man.
Kurt Vile, V-I-L-E, has a new CD. It's called Smoke Ring from My Halo. It made just about everyone's best of list last year. Beautiful melodies, a weary voice, more out of a Woody Guthrie era than today. Boston Globe critic James Reed says, shedding some of his cult status, this Philly singer-songwriter finally broke through with what he calls an epic folk record. One Reed says, flickers with traces of Neil Young and Lou Reed at their most rejected. Kurt Vile joins us now from WHYY in Philadelphia. Welcome.
Hi, thanks. Thanks, Robin.
Do you know that you're being played on NPR, NPR Between Reports?
You know, I hear about it sometimes, and sometimes I don't think about it. Other times I think about it, you know, all the time.
That's right, all the time. Well, okay, so Neil Young and Lou Reed at their most rejected, and we just heard some of that runner-ups. And, you know, here's some of the lyrics. Hey, old man, how many times we got to tell you? We don't want a number. Where you been so long? If it ain't working, take a whiz on the world.
Yeah.
Are you feeling rejected?
I wrote those lyrics, shoot, I think it was like 2008. You know, certain songs stay with me for a while. That's why I like the delivery to that song, because I've been playing it for years and years. So when I arrived at the studio, I kind of had this real... vibe. It was a piece of cake to, I know the lyrics, you know.
Inside out. But how would you describe the sound? As I said, there's this like shimmering guitars against this world-weary, we understand, recently turned 32-year-old voice. How would you, you know, what are you going for? It is your sound. What is it?
Very simple, kind of hypnotic finger-picking style. Also, I play with my band live in the studio, and we've all been playing together for a bunch of years now, so there's that whole like kind of chugging thing that you can only get with people you've been playing with for so long. And just something about the simplicity and the kind of sincerity and pretty melodic thing. Everybody bounces off of each other, you know, in this kind of hypnotic way. You know, it's natural.
Well, songs like Jesus Fever, let's listen to that. It's also on the new CD. Let's listen to a little and then we'll talk.
I packed my suitcase with myself, but I'm already gone. Cleanse myself with vitamins, but I'm already gone. I saw
something with those guitars. You find some sweet spot there. And then against that, this, you know, I'm already gone. You know, I cleanse myself with the vitamin health, but I'm already gone. It's sort of the, you know, two things smack up against each other. Your thoughts on it?
I don't know. Think about Neil Young or whoever, you know, or Joni Mitchell. I feel like they just write their best songs when it's kind of this somber thing going on. And for whatever reason, the, you know, those lyrics hit you at that time in the middle of the night, you know.
In my day I was young and crazy. One day I don't even know what was better.
I'm never like, oh, I'm fed up. I sit down and I want to get it all down on paper how bummed out I am, because I'm really not, you know. It's like a, it's just like a human kind of thing, you know.
Well, now when you say that this CD is an epic folk CD, what do you mean by that?
Sort of in reference to my past, my music being a little more psychedelic, I was listening, as always, but maybe it shined, you know, it came through a little more, just people like Burt Jansch or Joni Mitchell or Neil Young or whoever who has, you know, his folk and his rock side, but it's more that folk kind of feel. And, but, you know, I really went for it. It's not like pure folk. It, you know, it's got its weirdness and the crazy sonic textures and stuff, and I put a lot into it. Like, I tweaked the mixes and I kept adding more and more stuff, so it's very epic musically and sometimes like lyrically, or maybe more than I realized at the times. But you know, and it's just the most folk record I have so far, you know.
Well, and we've been hearing that, but there's also love songs. Let's listen to, and even in the love songs, you know, I suppose you can't resist. This sounds like a love song, Baby's Arms. You know, one true love in my baby's arms. But then I get sick of just about everyone and I hide in my baby's arms. Let's listen.
There's been but one true love in my baby's arms. In my baby's arms. And I got the hands to hold on. I get sick of just about everyone, and I hide my baby's arms.
I want to ask you about the last cut on the CD. It's called Shell Blues. What is that? It's like an old-timey record sound, an old-timey recording.
Yeah, I can tell you the secret. I record that at Magic Shop, which is a really awesome studio in Manhattan, and it was a keyboard called an Optigon. It's sort of like a Mellotron, and a Mellotron is like the earliest quote-unquote synth that's used on Strawberry Fields, but it plays tape loops of like strings or flutes. This plays little discs, little records, like acetates, and you just hit the button and it just plays this old-timey guitar loop.
So that's not you playing. That's an old acetate that was on it already, or you?
I don't know who played it, you know. But like the bell sounds very Tom Waitsy. If you ever listen to
sure,
like Frank's Wild Years or something. I feel like I've heard that same bell. It's like warbling bell, you know.
Oh, so others might have sampled it too, but we don't know who it is. That's interesting. So the title of the CD, Smoke Ring for My Halo, we'll go on that. And it means what?
It just means you're human, basically. Like, you're an angel, you know, but you're smoking a cigarette. So that kind of cancels you out. You're just human. You're just human after all. But the initial reason I titled the album that is because I really loved the way that song, the title track, came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want it to get ignored. I wanted to have an extra special attention because it's the one that comes across pretty straight.
So you didn't want it to get lost, so you made it the title. Well, we will make sure it doesn't get lost, and we're going to play it. Kurt Vile, his latest CD is called Smoke Ring for My Halo. You can hear a couple of his songs in their entirety at hearnow.org. Kurt, thanks so much for speaking with us. We'll see you. We'll hear you on Morning Edition.
Yeah, thank you.
Smoke ring for my halo. Angel, demon, human. Think I can see it now.
And by the way, a heads up for listeners in the Boston area. While at hearandnow.org, note that Kurt Vile will be playing at the Somerville Theater tomorrow night, along with Thurston Moore of Sonic Youth. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us to see what the week brings here and now.
Smoke ring for